This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaska-Narechamir. From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, we'll head for the Northwest Passage. Decreasing sea ice in the Arctic means increasing activity there, from oil and gas development to small pleasure boats.
When you see an expanse of ice and you've got to work your way through it, there's a great sense of accomplishment after coming through it.
Plus, the Coast Guard ramps up for an increased role in the north. That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Jessica Cochran. The past two summers have seen record low sea ice levels in the Arctic. Scientists with the National Snow and Ice Data Center say the average coverage for September was 1.8 million square miles, just slightly higher than last year's record low number. And the total volume of sea ice this year may be the lowest on record. That's because much of the ice that is there is thin, new ice. On this week's show, we'll look at what that means for Alaska. One result is an increase in the number of cruise ships and recreational boaters in the region. One such boat stopped in Kodiak last month. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
Walt Jones is the owner and captain of the Geraldine, a 46-foot former Maine lobster boat that he converted into a yacht over the past 2 years.
So people ask, is it the boat that caused you to do the Northwest Passage, or did the Northwest Passage attraction cause you to get the boat? And the answer is kind of yes, in both directions.
Jones is a tall man, maybe 6'3", 6'4", not exactly the type of guy you'd expect to be comfortable in the cramped 400 square feet of living space aboard the Geraldine. But have him give you a tour, and clearly he is. Just listen to him describe the pilot house slash salon.
What we say about this is that this is our living room, dining room, family room, den, you know, general purpose room. The whole thing is everything happens right here.
Below deck, there's a small galley, a pair of staterooms, and two tiny bathrooms. It's in this space that Jones and a revolving door crew, including his wife Kip, his boss, and his boss's son, spent 2.5 months journeying across the top of the world. They started in Southwest Harbor, Maine in late June, arriving in Kodiak in mid-September, on the way to their final destination of Sitka, where the Geraldine will stay permanently. When asked what in the world possessed him to try such a trip, Jones says, because it's there.
You know, it's an opportunity to do something that most people wouldn't normally do. And so there was a challenge of it. We have loved Southeast Alaska for some time, and we wanted a boat to be up here. And so we looked for a suitable vessel. And we thought, when we found one in Maine, we thought, why not do this trip? So we did an extensive refurbishment on the boat with the intention then of doing the Northwest Passage.
Kip Jones was aboard for the whole trip up until Nome, when she flew back to the family's home in the San Francisco Bay Area for a little break. She rejoined in Kodiak and says despite the close quarters, there's little, if any, tension, something she attributes to the home-cooked meals that she prepared every day.
I think if everybody smells something good cooking and knows that they're going to get something wonderful to eat for lunch or breakfast or dinner, and then to sit down together, it just sort of soothes that away. I think it happens in a home, but I think on the boat it was particularly important.
Besides the Joneses, the crew included Walt's boss, Pat Robertson, not the televangelist, and his son Shane, who joined up in Newfoundland. Walt, who worked high-tech jobs in Silicon Valley before becoming a fundraiser for the nonprofit and non-denominational City Team Ministries, says it's easy to take a leave of absence from your job when you invite your boss along for the ride.
He's my boss at City Team, but I was his boss on Geraldine.
Pat Robertson departed in Unalaska. Shane Robertson, who served as the Geraldine's unofficial mechanic, stayed up until they reached Seward. Shane says there's a huge sense of pride having gone through the Northwest Passage, which is still mostly ice with only the tiniest slivers of open water to navigate through.
When you see an expanse of ice and you've got to work your way through it, there's a great sense of accomplishment after coming through it. Even after with all of the failures, when you get to the end of it and you kind of look back and you say, we've made it through all of this, that is a huge highlight.
However, Walt Jones says the most difficult part of the trip wasn't going through the ice, which actually calms the ocean. The toughest part, he says, was the Bering Sea.
The Bering Sea is very unforgiving, and there's no place to go, and so you just have to tough it out, and it was pretty rough.
Jones says as far as anyone knows, there have only been 34 boats in history that have done the Northwest Passage, but he expects that it will become more common in the future.
I think so. The first American boat went through under 60 feet last year, and that was a boat called Cloud 9. It was a Bowman 57-foot sailboat. And they basically run the front page of the Wall Street Journal saying that they actually had no issues with ice whatsoever. They sailed right through. And so I thought many more people would attempt it this year, and I was quite surprised that they didn't. And I think we'll see more development. You know, Nome is putting extensive infrastructure in, getting ready for traffic.
In late September, the Geraldine arrived in Sitka. During their journey, the crew kept up a blog at mvgeraldine.com, where they posted pictures and observations about their once-in-a-lifetime adventure. In Kodiak, I'm Casey Kelly.
Walt Jones and his crew stopped in Nome on their trip. Nome Mayor Denise Michaels says the town has seen an increase in small boats, as well as in small cruise ships and industrial traffic, with Shell Oil doing seismic work in the Chukchi Sea. I spoke with Michaels about what this increased activity in the Arctic means for Nome. She says the city has already completed one harbor improvement project designed to handle increased traffic, and they're working on another to expand the port to accommodate deeper draft vessels.
The improvement of the port with all this resource development may provide more of an economic stimulus both to the city and to the state. And then we're also hoping that with this infrastructure, it'll increase our capability with our nation with critical nodes of homeland security and defense and presence in the Arctic.
Is it fairly shallow off the coast of Nome? Is that the problem, is to get out deep enough?
It is. It's gradual. It's a gradual slope. So right now we're at minus 22, and I think we need to go out another 1,000 feet to get to minus 50 to accommodate the bigger ships. Right now, the big cruise ships would not be able to come to the dock, and many of our icebreakers have to sit outside and then use either a helicopter or their small Zodiac boats to shuttle folks in.
So if they could pull up right to a causeway or a dock, that would be a lot easier, obviously.
Oh, it'd be a big improvement. Nome is in a unique position. We have 3 flights a day, so they can do crew changes. We have water and fuel at the dock, and we also have refuse service. So all of these would make it easier for ocean-going vessels to operate.
Have you been in touch with the Coast Guard about them possibly having an increased presence there?
Oh yes. We've been working with the Coast Guard for the last year, and have a great working relationship with them. They're also looking at various rural communities for possible forward operating location, not a base per se, but they'd like to use the existing facilities that are there. So Nome is really advocating hard that we are the best place in rural Alaska, Western Alaska. We have the existing port already there. We have existing facilities within the town where, you know, there's places to rent. We have restaurants.
So it sounds like there's a lot of opportunities there for you with increased traffic in the Arctic. What are the challenges?
Well, right now, funding is very hard to get with the atmosphere down in D.C. and even within the state ourselves. We're working really hard to bring this to the national level. Nome is the only port from Dutch Harbor North. With this climate change, this increased traffic, we need to be proactive instead of reactive. We don't want to have to react to something that happens to a ship out there in this cold water. We need that infrastructure in place, but it's really challenging to convince folks in D.C. that we are an Arctic nation and we do need a presence in the Arctic and we do need to protect our resources.
All right. I guess I'm kind of trying to think of the human impact on the community of having more people through. Is that something that people are excited about, or is there any nervousness or any challenges about the maybe increase in, more people coming through?
I think there is. One, on the subsistence side, we want to make sure that all this increased shipping does not hamper our ability to subsist in the ocean. Two, that, you know, they do respect our traditions and way of life. And in three, for the business side, they are excited about this. If we can get more tourism during the summer, that would help our economy a lot.
Denise Michaels has been mayor of Nome since 2003. A northwest passage from the Atlantic to the Orient was exploration's holy grail as far back as 1497. That's when Henry VIII charged Englishman John Cabot with finding a sea route to Asia north of the Arctic Circle through the icy Canadian archipelago. AK's Ellen Lockyer takes a look back.
Canadian singer Stan Rogers said it best.
For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea.
Many, since Cabot, have tried but failed to find the route. Perhaps the most celebrated failure was the expedition headed by Sir John Franklin in 1845. With two ships, 129 men, and provisions for 3 years, Franklin's foray into the unknown was the Victorian era's equivalent of the first space shuttle launch. Franklin's ships were last seen by whalers in Baffin Bay that year, then he dropped out of sight. Several rescue missions sent over the next decade came up empty-handed, but in 1854, Hudson's Bay Company surgeon and explorer Dr. John Ray found evidence of what had become of Franklin's party. Local Inuit led Ray to remote King William Island off what is now Nunavut, where skeletons and English artifacts were scattered in a deserted camp. The Inuit told him a large number of kablunas, or white men, had perished there. Russell Potter is a Franklin history buff.
They brought a lot of stuff that I think was more for trying to keep their sense of civilization rather than stuff that was actually going to be useful enough to be worth hauling it over miles and miles of frozen tundra. In a sense, they didn't have a plan B. And I think that and their sort of cultural arrogance, the belief that there was nothing to be learned from the Inuit. They didn't learn how to hunt sea mammals or seals. Even things they could have done, they didn't choose to do because they were confident in their own resources.
Potter is speaking here on Public TV's Nova, which a couple of years ago traced what may have happened to Franklin's expedition. Potter says that Franklin died in 1847, leaving behind a mysterious note found under a cairn of rocks on the island. Graves of some of Franklin's men were exhumed, and research indicated what may have befallen them, lead poisoning. In 1845, canned food was cutting edge, and the superbly outfitted expedition took lots of it along. But it was an imperfect technology at best, and researchers agree that lead leaking from the solder on the cans into the food may have poisoned Franklin's crew, sickening many and driving others mad. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
After the break, building new ships to suit the North. Stay with us. Welcome back to AK.
I'm Ellen Lockyer. Rescue missions that followed the Franklin disaster did accomplish one thing. They filled in the blank spots on the unreliable maps of the waterways that led to the Pacific. The entrance to the Northwest Passage was thought to lie off Davis Strait between Greenland and northern Canada. Dorn Van Domelen is a professor of geography at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
In medieval worldviews, there were believed to be these passages through the Arctic, and these make-believe passages were the ones that people were seeking after. The colonies in Greenland had been largely forgotten, but not forgotten by people who were fishing off of the Grand Banks of what we now call Canada. So no doubt, at least the fishermen who were working in this area knew that there were other places to go.
In the end, it was a Norwegian in a fishing boat who succeeded in finding the elusive water route. Roald Amundsen was, by his own account, a poor student who liked to ski and couldn't wait to break loose from an affluent family to search for the unknown. As a boy, Amundsen was intrigued by accounts of the doomed Franklin expedition. He dreamed of finding the Northwest Passage, and as a man, he set about it in a different way. Amundsen took only 6 crewmen aboard a lightweight herring vessel, the Gjoa, believing a small expedition was best. The Gjoa's crew spent 2 winters camped at King William Island, time they spent learning from the local Inuit to drive dog sleds, hunt caribou, and make clothing from reindeer skins. Amundsen succeeded in completing the traverse of the continent by water on August 26, 1905, when his crew spotted a whaling ship and realized they had made it to the Beaufort Sea. Amundsen's feat closed one era, but opened another. Amundsen's success and later political developments inadvertently triggered a Canadian national identity. In 1969, Exxon sent a reinforced oil tanker through the Northwest Passage from Alaska without Canada's permission.
Canadians were extremely upset, and they still look back at the day that the Manhattan made this passage. And in fact, the current government in Canada has as part of its foreign policy a desire to reestablish itself in the North by constructing more vessels that are able to navigate the Northwest Passage.
The Canadian Coast Guard launched a sonar search for the remains of Franklin's 2 ships this summer. If successful, some say the effort could further Canada's claims to control of the Northern Arctic. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The U.S. Coast Guard could be operating regular patrols in the Arctic Ocean as early as next summer. The Coast Guard has been testing its ability in the Arctic over the last couple of months, moving boats and helicopters to Barrow and Prudhoe Bay and conducting offshore operations. The agency also deployed its first ship without icebreaking capacity to the Arctic Ocean. Normally based in San Diego, that ship, the Hamilton, sailed past Barrow in open water, conducting search and rescue scenarios. On its way home, the cutter stopped in Juneau, where Rosemarie Alexander learned more about the Coast Guard's summer Arctic Ocean operations.
The Coast Guard cutter Hamilton is the first of its class, a so-called high-endurance ship which can take on longer missions than other cutters. It has gas turbine engines as well as diesel and can travel about 28 knots, useful in search and rescues. But the Hamilton is not built to plow through ice, and that was just the point of this mission.
If you would have told me in 1985 that we would have a high-endurance cutter going up into the Arctic, I would have questioned that greatly.
Captain Vincent De Laurentiis joined the Coast Guard in 1985. Climate change wasn't an issue. But Arctic sea ice has declined dramatically over the past 30 years, and the Arctic has become a new maritime domain. The Hamilton departed Dutch Harbor on August 21st, then proceeded north through the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort, following the retreating ice edge. On August 24th, it sailed into the Arctic Ocean. De Laurentiis says there was scattered ice, but no heavy concentrations.
Once you get to Barrow, it really opened up. About 12 miles offshore, we saw what they call lower concentrations of rotten ice, or ice that had broken off that ice edge. And those concentrations were a little bit further north of us, so we were able to navigate through there without a problem. On the way back, about 10 days later, the ice had shifted a little bit. And it shifted further south, and the ice was probably about 5 miles off the coast at that point, and that was more of that broken ice.
The high Arctic exercise also involved a C-130 fixed-wing aircraft, helicopter, and several small boats. During the mission, the Hamilton assisted the buoy tender Spar, a vessel out of Station Kodiak that can travel through thin ice, no more than a couple of feet thick. The icebreaker Healy also was in the Arctic this summer. It can continuously slice through 4.5 feet of ice at a speed of 3 knots, but is designed to cut ice up to 10 feet thick, though that takes some battering. The Polar Sea is capable of ramming up to 21 feet of ice and can continuously cut 6 feet at 3 knots. It conducted fisheries law enforcement, icebreaking, and scientific missions during the summer Arctic deployment. The Coast Guard has been sending heavy icebreakers into the Arctic Ocean for years, mainly for scientific research. Now that there's a significant area of open water, Captain De Laurentiis says cutters like the Hamilton are more versatile. That ship can launch and recover both boats and helicopters simultaneously.
This is our flight deck on board the Coast Guard cutter Hamilton. It's a 378-foot Coast Guard cutter. It's a multi-mission asset, and on this flight deck, these nets go down and we can land a Coast Guard helicopter similar to the ones that are at Air Station Kodiak, a 65 Dolphin helicopter.
The Hamilton's abilities proved crucial to the Coast Guard summer operations.
It was just a very rewarding and fabulous experience knowing that we could get up there, that we could operate and be able to perform.
17th Coast Guard Commander Rear Admiral Arthur Brooks says the Arctic West summer deployment was part of a broader investigation to help the agency come up with a plan for Arctic operations.
We pushed almost everything we had up there to see how it would work, and we're currently doing what I call a requirements build. We are looking at the number of ships we saw, the amount of Coast Guard work we experienced, and based on the other studies and the other information available, we're trying to predict how the vessel traffic will grow, which is our primary concern, and then what we need to do about it.
Brooks anticipates using cutters like the Hamilton for regular seasonal operations in the Arctic Ocean by next summer.
My personal opinion is we're going to have seasonal boat cutter and air coverage in the Arctic to deal with the potential for a commercial vessel casualty or a resupply vessel casualty, like the normal tug and barges that go up and resupply the villages, and or a mass casualty from one of these cruise ships. There aren't many of them, but it only takes one to have a real problem.
If oil exploration increases in U.S. Arctic waters, it also will require more Coast Guard support. And other Arctic countries are looking to the north.
They're looking for development opportunities. They're looking for ways to relate and support indigenous people. They're looking for ways to protect the environment. And those are local, state, national questions that need to be addressed among Americans and among the Arctic nations. How are we going to do this? It's clear that with climate change, we are going to have to do something in the Arctic. Things are happening and will continue to happen, and we're all going to have to deal with it. The only question is how. That's really not a Coast Guard decision. My job is to provide maritime safety and security to the decisions of others, and so I'm just trying to engage America in the conversation.
Brooks says regular seasonal operations will depend on U.S. policy and how much Washington wants to spend in the Arctic. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Coast Guard's expanded role in the Arctic will likely include monitoring and assisting a whole new breed of boat, more flexible icebreakers designed for Arctic waters. And some of them may be built here in Alaska. In Ketchikan, an innovative ship is being built to handle variable waters. It's a joint effort of the Office of Naval Research and the Matsu Borough, and its original purpose was to serve as a ferry in Kinnick Arm. The ship can transport cars, land on beaches, break ice, and even transform itself into a fast-moving catamaran. As new routes emerge in icy waters, Alaska Ship and Dry Dock is in a position to build more new boats like it. Scott Burton has more.
This is a very interesting ship.
Lou Madden knows because he led the design team that developed it. After graduating from Anchorage's West High School, he attended the Naval Academy, went on to become a Navy captain, and then went to work for Lockheed Marine Systems in Seattle. Madden is now Matsu's owner representative working with Alaska Ship and Dry Dock in Ketchikan, where the ship is being built.
I've been told that it's the most complicated ship, the most innovative ship developed in the last 100 years. It is the world's only icebreaking catamaran. It is the world's only variable deck landing craft. In fact, you start to wish that maybe one or two things weren't the world's first, because that makes it very complicated.
Alaska Ship and Dry Dock was constructed in the 80s by the state to provide an in-state facility to service the ferry fleet. Doug Ward is the director of shipyard development.
We have a 10,000-ton floating dry dock that I'm looking out at right now. The Kennecott is sitting in dry dock now, and right next to it is the Columbia, two of the largest state ferries which we're able to serve. And now we're developing the facilities to pursue that 250-foot ship-class vessel, which we call the Alaska Design Vessel, which constitutes 95% of the ships that operate in Alaska.
Ward would like to see Ketchikan become a center for northern watership construction with its ice-free protected deepwater harbor.
The new dry dock is actually a land-level ship transfer system that allows us to lift and transfer 250-foot-long ships into fully enclosed all-weather repair hulls. And as far as I know, there's no other ship repair yard in North America that can do that.
Ward says they've had Arctic waters on their radar since the late 90s.
We started trying to read the tea leaves for what was in the future for the Ketchikan shipyard. And even back then, there was indications that the Northwest Passage and the Northeast Passages may at some time, in what we thought then and what kind of the conventional wisdom was, sometime way out in the distant future, that sea ice might recede to make those northern Arctic passages commercially viable.
So while the founders of the shipyard mostly wanted an in-state facility to service state ferries, Ward has bigger goals. Lou Madden says the shipyard is well positioned to do that. After all, its experience is unique.
Bear in mind that they've constructed the world's only steel-hulled catamaran icebreaker. So, yeah, I think that's going to be a very viable yard and a center of industry for the North. It's the northernmost shipyard in the United States right now, capable of building a ship and repair of the offshore oil support vessels and so on. Yeah, I think that's going to be a big business. I think you can expect to see a shipping boom throughout the coast of Alaska, but especially in Ketchikan.
The shipyard's first cool new boat, a groundbreaking icebreaker, if you will, is scheduled to hit the water in early 2010. The Susitna was designed for conditions in Cook Inlet and won't motor the even icier waters at the Northwest Passage anytime soon. For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
Less ice in the Arctic may present development opportunities, but it's not great news for subsistence users. On this week's segment of 300 Villages, we'll head to Point Lay on the North Slope. After that, a stop in Hope on the Kenai.
My name is Frederica Stocker. I live at Point Lay, Alaska, along the coast from Wainwright and Barrow. We have around 250 people living around here. Usually this time of the year, we're all going out fish camping. We have a lot of snow. Right now it just started snowing and the ice is still getting thick. The ocean is still got water. Usually there's ice out there. We notice our ground around here is dropping. We go out ice fishing, duck hunting, seal, bearded seal hunting, caribou hunting. And we just recently got a quota, so we got two whaling captains in our village that is trying to go out and go whaling. For myself, I see it's getting harder for us because we used to be able to go out onto the ice in the ocean, but now there's no ice and the bears are more closer to our village and it gets more dangerous. They do come into our village and that's when we have a bear patrol. We have a very, very young group that participate in Eskimo dance. We have young drummers. We have young dancers. And they came a long way just, you know, learning from our elders. And it is a lot of fun to see our younger generation getting into our way of life. And they're excited about it. They have the songs and the drums to pass on to the next generation, and they're really proud of it.
My name is Fairine Sherritt. I live here in Hope on 2nd Street, which is in the historic part of Hope, an old mining community that where gold was found in 1888 and really started the gold rush to Alaska. Hope is located south of Anchorage across Turnagain Arm. The population of Hope runs between 130 and 150 people on a year-round basis. In the summertime, we have more people because there's a number of people who have summer cabins. I think as far as challenges go, the main one is keeping our school open. Our average age is much higher, and the fact that there aren't a lot of employment opportunities here. Younger families are not necessarily coming this direction to make Hope a home. So our school every year is at risk of being closed because of the number of students that we have or don't have. And we must have 10 to stay open, and currently we have 11.
We heard from Frederica Stocker in Point Lay and Fairine Sherritt in Hope. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Coming up after the break, preparing the U.S. for an increased role in the Arctic might just start with a little bang.
And then all of a sudden there's a big crash, boom, bang, and lots of smoke, and then Dave comes out with a bunch of wire on his head.
That's ahead. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Jessica Cochran, and this week we're talking about the Northwest Passage. Traffic in the Arctic is already increasing, in some cases rapidly. Greenland has seen cruise ship traffic go way up, regular old ships, not icebreakers. And in northern Russia, a pair of new ice-breaking oil tankers are delivering oil from a state-of-the-art platform to Ramansk. With all the activity, one question that arises is, who owns what and who controls what? I put that question to Ben Ellis, Managing Director of the Institute of the North. He's been working on an international assessment of Arctic marine shipping.
It does get a little confusing, but it's pretty simple in the sense that the Arctic is an ocean. A lot of people forget that. Even though it's frozen for a majority of the year, it is an ocean. Therefore, all international laws, shipping laws, modes of transit, freedom of navigation apply to it. So, within international waters, there is no ownership. What gets a little confusing to people is the United Nations Law of the Sea Convention Treaty, which deals with the subsurface off the continental shelf of nations. And under the UNCLOS, as it's called, agreement, if a country can show that their continental shelf extends further out than 200 miles where the country's sovereignty extends the present time, then they can make a claim that they own the subsurface of that area. This was sort of brought to light in a very dramatic way last December when Artur Chilangarov from Russia planted a Russian flag at the North Pole in a submersible, virtually claiming about a quarter of the Arctic subsurface as being Russian territory. Now, that has to go to the United Nations to be arbitrated, and Russia and any country has to provide scientific data that the area there is a extension of their continental shelf, and there would be a decision made. So there's sort of two issues that are going on at the present time. Within Canada, there's a difference of opinion between the United States and Canada as to the waters that are in and between their archipelagos. The United States sees that as international waters. Canada sees that as Canadian waters. And so there is a dispute between the two countries in that area.
Is that one of the things that you're looking at in the shipping assessment?
Not so much the disputes, but the when you look at shipping in the future, there are two sort of drivers that we see that will shape shipping in the future in the Arctic Ocean. One is resource development trade, along with a little bit of tourism, but mainly resource development, oil and gas development, if you want to get it down to a one product. That and governance. And governance is an issue that covers the area of law or of providing insurance or security so that a company that wants to operate within the Arctic, a shipping company, has some level of confidence that the laws between nations, like I said, the rite of passage, all of that is somewhat uniform, or at least is connected, so that you're not running and bumping into one set of regulations and then another set of regulations as you're going through the Arctic Ocean. So governance and resource development are the things that seem to be needed to increase transport within the Arctic Ocean.
Sorry, so you're saying that we need to actually have resource development there for it to be worth having a significant trip?
Well, yeah. One thing that I might point out is that the reduction of sea ice in the summertime, and I want to stress that we're talking about reduction of sea ice in the summertime. In the wintertime, in the polar night, there's a lot of ice up there. And one of my expert friends has properly noted, if the ice goes away in the wintertime, we're not going to have a problem because the Earth's going to be so warm, we're not going to be able to survive. So we're talking about a small window of opportunity within the Arctic Ocean. And today there is a lot of traffic within the Arctic, within the regional type or destinational type of traffic. Alaska's got a good example. We have ships that go to Red Dog in the summertime, pull out product there. We've had and will probably have more seismic activity in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea as far as exploration goes. And those types of activities we see throughout the Arctic increasing, especially in the Russian Arctic near Murmansk and in the Barents Sea area. That particular region is going to see a significant increase of ship traffic over the next 10 years, and it's all because of oil and gas. So the concept that, well, the Arctic is going to be ice-free, therefore there's going to be trans-Arctic shipping, is sometimes where, unfortunately, the press gets the wrong impression. Everything that we see and the companies that we talk to and the countries that we talk to, the increase in activity is regional activity and maybe longer shoulder seasons of that regional activity. But because the ice is so unpredictable of where it's going to be, for shipping companies to be able to guarantee that they can ship trans-Arctic and make the port of call at the time of their destination is still very, very problematic.
Ben Ellis is traveling in Canada, Finland, and Norway, wrapping up work on an Arctic marine shipping assessment. It will be presented to the Ministerial Board of the Arctic Council next spring.
It's all a matter of perspective. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Mead Treadwell, who chairs the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, points to a map laid out on his desk.
Take that map of the world and spread it out so the Arctic is on the top in the middle, and you can see there's a lot of ways to get from the North Pacific to the North Atlantic.
The North Pole lies at the center, a hub circled by Russia, Alaska, Canada, and the Scandinavian countries, like the spokes of a wheel. Treadwell says there's really a number of passages opening up, due more to climate change than anything else. There's a northeast passage through Russia, for instance.
The Russians have been sailing along the northern coast of Russia for most of the last century. So you've got the route across Russia, the route across the top of Canada. Frankly, you have the possibility now of transarctic shipping. We did a study at the Institute of the North about 3 years ago now for the state of Alaska and ADAC, where we looked at the preliminary economics and technologies that could use a container shuttle that would go from ADAC to Iceland and cut straight across the Arctic Ocean, ignoring both the Northwest Passage and the Northeast Passage.
Now, a route straight across from Alaska to Iceland is a long shot, but if it ever happens, it could make Alaska a center of shipping. But one thing stands in the way: ice. At least for now.
We had a huge outflow of multi-year ice last spring from the Arctic Ocean. So what was replacing that was thin annual ice. Old ice is less and less of a percentage component of what you see in the Arctic ice pack. The idea that you're going to have much more navigable ice is one that the scientists are predicting with fairly strong confidence right now.
Treadwell says a cross-polar route would depend on state-of-the-art ice-breaking ships.
Technology is changing. Icebreakers are much more efficient, and it used to be if you were riding on a bowl-shaped or a spoon-shaped bow of an icebreaker, it's no fun once you get into open water because you're rocking and rolling quite a bit. Well, the new design for icebreakers has a V-shaped bow and a spoon-shaped stern and propulsion that can turn any direction at all. And so you can, in essence, back into the ice and move forward in open water.
The state has requested federal funds for two $750 million icebreakers. Treadwell cautions that the success of any polar shipping route would depend on the cooperation of all the Arctic nations it serves. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
What wonder will we find ahead? What new lands will we ravage? Will sirens call shipwreck us all beyond the Northwest Passage?
The prospect of a more industrialized Arctic has environmental groups concerned. Oceana, an international ocean conservation organization, is working to put the far North Seas off limits to fishing. Arctic project manager Dr. Chris Krenz was at the recent North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting in Anchorage.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is really leading the way and setting what we think is a very wise and prudent example of how to manage industrialization in the Arctic. They're in the process of closing that region to commercial fishing until they know a lot more about the region and would be able to manage that region sustainably.
Right now, there is no commercial fishing in the Arctic, but Krenz says as the climate warms, warm water fish will travel farther north, and fishermen won't be far behind.
This puts in place the management framework for the potential of future fisheries, but doing so in a proactive approach instead of letting fisheries develop there and then having management catch up with the fisheries. This is putting a framework in place that closes the region until there is enough known to manage it for fisheries sustainably without impacting the health of the ecosystem or opportunities for the subsistence way of life.
Krenz says the sea ice is melting fast, so it's important to get some rules in place now. He says the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's action will help protect the subsistence way of life by keeping fishing boats out until we learn how industrial fishing interacts with subsistence activities in the Arctic ecosystem. Many experts agree with a more active Arctic, a more global world, it will be more important than ever for the U.S. to keep up when it comes to science. The Department of Energy says the average age of the scientific workforce is more than 55, and within 10 years, these baby boomers will be retiring, shrinking the number of scientists in the U.S. to half what it is now. Some are even calling better science and technology education a matter of national security. Maybe that's why the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Division was one of the sponsors of a recent science performance in Sitka. It's part of an effort to get more kids interested in science at a young age. AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock attended the show called Totally Electric.
Scientists Rick Lee and Alex Nagy have day jobs working on fusion reactors at General Atomics in San Diego. But on the side, they travel to places like Kauai, Riverside, and now Sitka, putting on science shows for kids like this one called Totally Electric.
So they work a lot with plasmas, and this is one example of a plasma beam.
They make a lot of noise, and there's whirring and blinking lights and smoke up on stage. Both Nagy and Lee say if they aren't having fun, their audience probably isn't either. Whether it's explaining plasma or using energy to slice and dice or blow up a cucumber, these guys have it down.
Alice is going to discharge a high current through that pancake coil. That's going to induce eddy currents in the aluminum. It's going to come up, shooting up, and we'll see how nicely, nice and clean, it slices that cucumber. You'll be amazed. We'll need a countdown.
People are really far away from
this.
Yeah,
we've seen this before.
Ready, 3, 2, 1. I think I have cucumber in my hair.
Yeah, you do. Yes, you do have cucumber in your hair. And it looks lovely.
That was a trial run of the cucumber out in the parking lot so Nagy and Lee could assess how messy it would be in the auditorium. And of course, it was a huge hit when performed on stage, with a big plastic barrier between the audience and the reigning Cuke. As 11-year-old Jack Peterson attests, anything that made noise or looked remotely dangerous was also a plus.
Oh, I thought it was really cool, especially with the part when Rick said, keep an eye out for Dave, because sometimes he can get into mischief, and then all of a sudden there's a big crash, boom, bang, and lots of smoke, and then Dave comes out with a bunch of wire on his head.
What do you think about going into some kind of a science-related field, or do you have some other ideas?
I think that if I really put my mind to it, I can basically invent anything.
That's the kind of optimism the sponsors of Totally Electric hope to generate. And 11-year-old Alex Korak was so inspired, he wants to recreate some of what he saw on stage.
Well, they had this shock thing. It would go tss. When they put it on metal, it would go tss. And I really wanted to do that.
Do you know what you're going to do later in life? Are you thinking of a science career at all?
I don't know. I know I want to play football, but after I retire from that, which is normally around like 31, 32, I have no real plans, so this might be one.
9-year-old Zachary Wright says his favorite part was being shot at with huge smoke rings, and most of what he saw was new to him.
75% of it I learned. 25% I already knew, but all the rest I've learned.
Is science kind of your thing? Would you be interested in going into a career in science?
Yeah, I'm actually into everything. Everything except writing.
That interest is what the scientists want to hear from these kids. Nagy says the U.S. hasn't done a good job drawing kids into science.
All of the science and technology divisions in all the colleges are full and overflowing. However, 80% of those students are not from the United States. And so what does that tell you? We're educating the world, and we're doing a great job at it, but our guys are saying we're not interested.
In Sitka, kids are surrounded by science because of the environment they live in. And Karen Jones, the local project coordinator of this particular show, says she understands the global push for the U.S. to produce scientists, but there's also a need for that knowledge to stay right here at home.
And the other thing that we're trying to do is get our kids in Sitka educated in these fields, choose these fields, and stay in Sitka, not to go out somewhere else.
And Joan says that's true about Alaska in general. She spent 3 months talking to science and technology professionals around the state who all support this effort to attract kids into science-related jobs that will keep Alaskan kids in Alaska. The D.C.-based science and technology firm Envisioneering is one of the partners for this project. Director David Starkston says he was surprised at the depth of knowledge Sitka kids have.
Well, we were talking about, you know, fish and game and the whole idea of tracking fish and cutting up the fish to look, get the tags out and see which fisheries they came from. That's a whole new area for me that I don't get exposed to a lot.
Fishery science will probably play an even bigger role in the future because of the drastic changes facing the Arctic. Alex Nagy says we've pretty much developed the food industries and the fish-catching industries, and we need science to show us the next step.
And so science and technology is really the open-ended occupation or the avenue of exploration so that we can better utilize the limited resources that we have on this planet and then eventually get out to the rest of the universe, right? We're not out yet, but it's kind of like that's the only answer to an expanding population on the earth, you know.
Sitka science teacher Jackie DeGennaro says bringing in outside experts in these fields complements what they are already doing in the schools. And she says Sitka kids are not afraid of thinking about the world in scientific terms.
You know, one of my main objectives as a science teacher is to get kids excited about science and to think of themselves as scientists when they're real little. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of that already, but it's always great to have some help.
And so what we're going to do here is we have it plugged in. The red light here is ready to go. I'm going to turn it on.
Organizers hope to make this science show an annual event. So hopefully next year, the Science and Technology Education Partnership will be back, launching Coke cans and cucumbers and luring kids into the wonderful and wacky world of science.
I'll just stand behind you. Go ahead. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Okay, so that's... Well, you know, it takes more energy because it's heavier.
For AK, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's AK for this week. We had help from Casey Kelly in Kodiak and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org, and check out the text rundown on the archives page. You can also sign up for our podcast, check out our archives, and send us an email to let us know how we're doing. Or email us directly at ak@aprn.org. AK's Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage this week, Scott Burton from Juneau, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock from Sitka. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Jessica Cochran. Join us again next week.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.